This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
Good evening, and welcome to The Body Politic. I'm Peter Gourevitch. Tonight, it's post-Olympics China and the post-primary presidential campaign. We'll start with China. Many of you have watched part of the 29th Olympiad in Beijing, which put China front and center in the news for the past 2 weeks. For some insight into what this means for China and for U.S.-Chinese relations in the aftermath, we turn to Susan Shirk and Barry Naughton. Susan Shirk is the director of the Institute on Global Conflict and Cooperation at the University of California and a UCSD professor, and a former State Department official on East Asian affairs. She's also the author of the new book, China, Fragile Superpower. Barry Naughton is a professor of Chinese economy at the School of International Relations and Pacific Studies at the University of California, San Diego. Welcome to both of you, and it's going to be great to talk to you about this. So China campaigned long and hard for the privilege of getting these Olympics. Let's try to evaluate it. Did China get what it wanted out of these Olympics?
I'd say absolutely. What it wanted was not just international respect, mm-hmm. but domestic support. Mm-hmm. And certainly the Chinese public feels very identified with the Chinese government right now. And that's the result not just of the Olympics, but of this sequence of events over the last 6 months, including the Tibet protests, the earthquake in which Chinese government responded very forcefully and effectively, and then, of course, this very successful Olympics.
So you're saying they got a big boost at home.
They got a big boost at home, and I think we tend to focus on China's trying to win our approval.
Right.
But first and foremost, China's trying to win the approval of its own people.
Okay, and what did you think the international impact has been?
I think the world's been wowed mm-hmm. by the Olympics. I think exactly what the Chinese government had hoped for. Mm-hmm. They basically put a lid on all petitioning, demonstrations, the media, and so everything looks very smooth, unanimous, enthusiastic, and of course the facilities are fabulous, the organization is fabulous, the Chinese athletes are fabulous, the opening ceremony knocked everyone's socks off.
Right.
So, you know, and I think it reminds people also of Chinese cultural tradition, mm-hmm. which is combined with this new technology, is a pretty powerful kind of soft power.
It's the high modern with the old traditional combined. Mm-hmm. And I mean, those buildings are quite remarkable. And every time you look at it, you see them. So that is kind of interesting. Well, Barry, what do you think? What's the economic impact? That's another thing that's happened. There's this huge activity and lots of money. What's the impact? How do we think about that?
Yeah. Well, of course, nobody knows for sure how much the Chinese really invested in the Olympics. And in a way, it's a difficult question because they put so much into improving the Beijing cityscape and improving the highways and their three new subway lines opened before the Olympics. You know, do we count all those investments as part of the Olympics? Well, in some sense they are, but of course in another sense they're also just part of a rapidly modernizing economy. They certainly spent a lot on it, and I'd agree very much with Susan. They got a lot out of it. I mean, this was really China's emergence on the world scene. I would add one thing, though, and that is they did fail to get one thing that they could easily have gotten. In other words, they could easily have allowed a few token protests, liberalized a little bit, and then they would really have had mastery of the story, right? Because then the story would have been China's emergence as a mature power. I'm sure you do, but I mean that they failed to do by being overly
controlled. If they had given a little opening on the political side in the lead up to the Olympics,
and you think they did not out of insecurity about they didn't know they could control it, right?
Yeah.
What's going to happen from here? I mean, on the political side, is there going to be a crackdown? Are they going to try to be more open? Any way to speculate on post-Olympics China?
Well, politically, during the earthquake, we did see a little period of opening when the media was much more informative about what was actually going on in terms of casualties and problems on the ground. And also they allowed individuals, civil society emerged. People came out to help the earthquake victims. And it was a kind of glimpse of a China that could be in the future.
And but a great then, contrast with Myanmar, remember, at the time,
right,
doing the opposite.
Right.
It was
absolutely
very striking. Yeah.
But then just a week or so afterwards, we went back to business as usual and, in fact, even a tighter control because of the upcoming Olympics. Mm. I don't think we're going to see any loosening up. I don't see any major change coming after the Olympics. I think now they feel they've got a formula that works quite well. Popular support is there. You don't have a lot of, except for some urban intellectuals, really, you don't have massive discontent in China. You have people who are unhappy about particular local situations. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, I don't see any pressure to initiate political reform at this point.
Well, Susan, you, this tremendously interesting book you wrote is called China, Fragile Superpower. Mm-hmm. And explain that title to us. What is, why did you pick that? What does it mean? It's such a nice tension of two words and...
Well, what it means is that we outside of China tend to look at China as so dramatically successful and as an emerging superpower. Right. And we don't pay very much attention to all the problems that China has domestically, and in particular to this intense insecurity that China's leaders have as Communist Party politicians about how long they can maintain power in this society that's been turned upside down by market reform and opening. So Fragile really speaks primarily to the problems, the political problems China has, and to this intense insecurity on the part of its leaders.
Mm-hmm. Do you see that in the economy as well? Is that a phrase? If you were writing a book on the economy, would you like that phrase?
Yeah, I think it's a really good description of China. I mean, it captures the fact that the growth has been so dynamic, and I mean, for the last 5 years, China's economy has been growing at just super, super fast rates, and yet we also see that there seems to be this economic vulnerability. The level of technology is still, you know, relatively low. Many problems of poverty and migration are still very, very serious. So, yeah, I think economically it makes a lot of sense to see it as a hugely successful country, but one that's got lots of problems that they're very aware of.
Well, so let's again go back to where is this going to take us. I mean, if you're a leadership with lots of problems, political and economic, how does this help us understand to evaluate what they're likely to do? If you were in the government, you're giving advice, you give advice in a way. How does your advice influence by your perception that this is a fragile superpower? A lot of the editorials I've been reading the last week talk Chinese power, that's what they hit on.
Yeah.
They don't mention the fragile, so how do you give advice that incorporates the fragile?
It doesn't mean we just appease China, but it means that we ought to think twice every time we say and do something toward China, recognizing that what we do is going to resonate through Chinese domestic politics. Because now you can't keep secrets from the Chinese people. So they're going to know what our politicians are saying and doing. So we just think twice. Is it really going to do, when we make a statement or take an action, are we really going to improve the situation on the ground? Or are our politicians just posturing for political reasons to our domestic public? So taking pot shots at China is no longer cost-free. You know, for a long time, especially in the Congress, there was just absolutely no downside to trying to look strong in defense of America by taking pot shots at China. But now I think it's time to think twice and speak and express our own values and our criticism, but make sure that it's actually going to accomplish something on the ground.
So you're critical of cheap talk. You've got to evaluate everything you say has a cost. You've got to think carefully about what it is.
Yeah, because there'll be a domestic reaction inside China. My other advice is to maintain our own economic and military strength. Mm-hmm. Because there are a lot of pressures inside China now on the leadership to stand tall, act strong, and possibly to make threats toward Japan or toward Taiwan. And when the Chinese government is feeling that kind of domestic pressure, I want them to look out over the Pacific and see a strong U.S. military so that they think twice before making threats that then they might feel they couldn't back down from.
Barry, how does the fragility affect advice you give about U.S.-Chinese economic relations?
It's funny. It's a very difficult phase, of course, in the world economy. So, you know, one of the funny things that's happened is that whereas just a year or two ago, the Chinese and the U.S. government were really kind of at loggerheads about exchange rate policy and other kinds of economic issues, now all of a sudden everybody has sort of pulled back a little bit. Everybody's waiting to see, you know, whether the U.S. is going to go into a recession, whether the world economy will go into a recession. So I think it's more maybe on the economic side, we've already heeded some of that advice and we're a little more cautious about telling China what to do. China, on the other hand, is definitely in a wait-and-see mode as they've already let their currency appreciate by a significant chunk against the U.S. dollar, and now they're waiting to see what's going to happen to the world economy, what's going to happen to the Chinese economy after the Olympics. Mm-hmm. So, and also in China, we have a new leadership group in terms of economics, so we're not quite sure how they're going to react. So I think everybody's sort of on hold in that sense.
What about inflation?
Well, inflation is that's a great question because the inflation that started last year really finally convinced the Chinese to let their currency appreciate, you know, to moderate some of the oil price pressures, the energy pressures, and they had their own food price surge. But one of the things they did was keep a cap on energy prices, electricity prices, because they were so afraid of inflation. They had to start subsidizing sectors. Mm-hmm. Now, presumably, they're going to let that go now that the Olympics are gone, because otherwise it'll just become too expensive. What happens then? They don't know what's going to happen. We don't know either.
So a lot of uncertainty, a lot of caution, and therefore a little verbal restraint on both sides. People aren't quite sure what's going on. Well, what about the election? Do we have any reason to think that Obama or McCain would do anything different than what's going on now, than the Bush policy? I mean, does it matter which of them wins in terms of American foreign policy? Would you predict a difference or what? What's your sense?
I don't think there's going to be a great deal of difference from the current policy toward China or from the policy that we've basically had over the past seven administrations, Democrat and Republican. Mm-hmm. You know, what always happens, we have a common pattern. In the first year or two of an administration, the new administration tries to show that it's doing something different toward China. It's going to take a tougher stand to show its strong leadership. Mm-hmm. This never works. Mm-hmm. It doesn't lead to any positive outcomes. Mm-hmm. So after a couple of years, they settle down to trying to cooperate with China while maintaining our own strength, basically what we call, as a shorthand, an engagement policy. Mm-hmm. And so I would expect that both Senators Obama and McCain would take the same approach. The one difference, the one thing I'm a Democrat, but the one thing I do always worry about with Democratic presidents is because they are more dependent on labor, organized labor, there's a tendency toward more economic protectionism and blaming a lot of our own economic problems on China. So you may see a tougher position on economic issues and the economic
by the Democrats because of their protectionist pressures.
That's right. Yeah.
On the other hand, I very much agree with that. On the other hand, McCain also has this idea of a league of democracies and the idea that you know, the democratic power should be a little tougher on the non-democratic power. And while he's been pretty careful so far, to not sort of directly apply that to China. Clearly, it sort of implicitly, right. you know, targets China. And so maybe there's also a mirror image danger.
Well, can we criticize China ever? I mean, this is such a complicated relationship now. We need them for so many things. Mm-hmm. Are there things you think we can make legitimate and strong criticisms on?
Oh, there's lots to criticize. I mean, not just human rights, but also environmental policy, mm-hmm. which, of course, has impacts on us, too. But the challenge is not just to do, you know, megaphone diplomacy of criticizing, get on our soapbox and criticize, but figure out how to actually improve the situation on the ground. And it's very, very difficult, especially on human rights, because that relates to this concern China's leaders have about maintaining power.
Right. And on economics, the same. Yeah,
I mean, we have a responsibility, I think, to criticize. Because they need ideas and they need pathways to the future. And, you know, one thing we forget about China is, although it's still autocratic, the Communist Party has adopted all these sort of mechanisms to elicit commentary and you know, get consent and talk with different sectors of society. But, you know, we shouldn't mistake it for democratic reforms. They're not. But they are sort of interesting efforts to be more inclusive and to bring things in.
Well, thanks both very much. This is a lot to talk about, and we're going to keep going, I hope, in the future sometime. My guests have been Susan Shirk and Barry Naughton, both on the faculty here at UC San Diego. Next up, the state of the presidential campaign as the presumptives become the nominees. The longest presidential race in history is finally heading into the general election, where Barack Obama and John McCain will spend the next 2 months trying to close the deal with American voters. What happens between now and November will be of great interest to many of us, and no one more so than Sam Popkin. Sam is an expert on public opinion analysis, a professor of political science at UCSD, and a former polling consultant to the Clinton and Gore campaigns, and the author of The Reasoning Voter. Welcome, Sam. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this stuff.
Nice to be here again.
It's great. So, Sam, what we're faced with are not the candidates that many people expected 6 to 8 months ago. The leading runners from them aren't the ones we have now. How would you analyze what happened? Let's start with the Clinton campaign and then go look at Giuliani. Why did the expectations not turn out this way?
Well, before the election started, Peter, I'm working on a book on candidates and campaigns, not on voters. And I had a chapter outlined, why great senators make bad candidates. And then I naively said, well, Hillary is an exception, when I was interviewed at the beginning of the race, because I thought all her presidential experience would override her Senate experience. And senators have a very bad time, good senators who are really involved, because they have a staff that's trained to make deals, compromises, and get things done. I mean, there is no legislation without all sorts of complicated negotiations between union heads and CEOs and the Pope, maybe, or the head of a church. So you deal with the elite. That's different than talking to people in New Hampshire and Iowa. It's different from the kind of staff that knows what to say to the people in Iowa. And she got stuck with the wrong kind of people and then was astonishingly slow to change. John McCain is more like Barack Obama and John Kennedy, people who never really became very good senators, who really never got involved, who sort of stayed back. And I think, frankly, what really, really pulled him through was the fact that the religious right collapsed after the scandals involving Abramoff, DeLay, and Ralph Reed, and there was nobody else that anybody at the beginning thought would win. I thought Giuliani might actually win this time. And he ran an ego campaign. The day I think it really went downhill from then on for him was the day in a big conservative forum where he was introduced by George Will and given the best shot any New Yorker will ever get at having the Republican nomination. He was asked about global warming, and he said, you saw the tough things I did in New York. This is no tougher than what I did in New York. I can do that too. He hadn't done anything. He was just sort of saying, I'm tough, I'm good, I'll figure it out.
Well, let's think about things that might be new in this campaign. A lot of attention. You love to read polls. I love to read polls. There's a lot of discussion about new voters. Are there new voters? Do we know anything about?
There was all this talk. Well, my favorite line of the campaign was Hillary's pollster, Mark Penn, scoffing at a poll the day before the Iowa caucus. The Des Moines Register did a perfect poll that got it to the decimal point on what happened the next day in the caucus. And Mark Penn said, this is absurd. This doesn't look like a caucus poll. It looks like YouTube, mm-hmm. or it looks like Facebook. Mm-hmm. In fact, it did look like Facebook, and it was accurate. There was an enormous youth vote, but percentage-wise, what people hadn't realized was everybody was going to vote. The vote doubled from 2004, but the actual under 30 percentage went from 19 to 22. So we had a small increase in the youth vote.
Right.
Where you did get a big increase was minority communities.
Right.
It was in North Carolina or Texas. Places where you don't get usually a big minority vote in primaries. And the question is, will all those red state minority votes matter? We don't really know yet.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember 30 years ago, I remember you telling me, you know, what's going to happen depends on who turns out to vote. And that drives the pollsters crazy because if that varies, they have trouble predicting. It's all based on probable voters.
It's not going to change as much as people
think. It's not.
Okay. I think the Obama, if it's going to change, this would be a good year because the Obama campaign is the first Democratic campaign to give a high enough priority to turnout. Now, turnout has been going up. Turnout in 2004 was the highest we've had since 1972. And so there is going to be a reasonably high turnout. I can easily say that at the level of the Senate and Congress, the Democrats are going to have a strong, very good year. Mm-hmm. It's almost impossible to say right now at the presidential level whether Barack Obama can hold the states mm-hmm. where there's a lot of less educated white voters who are very suspicious of anybody that comes from an inner-city African-American constituency. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Not all of us, not everybody in America sees him as a success. A lot of people just see him as not that different from Jesse Jackson Sr. And
I find that quite fascinating because there was this tension between him and Jesse Jackson. I mean, I see him as very different from Jesse Jackson.
And so does Jesse Jackson Jr.
Jesse Jackson sees him as different from himself.
And Jesse Jackson resents
it. But you would think the public does. Yeah, Jesse Jackson resents it.
Jackson rightfully resents Barack Obama as a person who doesn't want to have a constituency on one side of a wall. Some in both the white and the black communities in America, there are people who profit from apartheid.
Right.
People whose constituencies either can't cross the wall or don't want the wall to be torn down. Obama, Jesse Jackson Jr., Harold Ford are a whole new world. And young people who have gone to school with this kind of a mix see him as part of their world. Right. Older Americans just remember, they're all Black Panthers, or how can you trust them? They must hate us too. So I've never seen
anything.
So that
explains the generational divide.
It's extraordinary among white Americans, especially less educated white Americans.
Right. So it is going to turn on who turns out, then it's going to go back to
But I don't. I think we know pretty much who's going to turn out.
We don't know who's going
to
vote.
And we don't really know whether when people get to think of Obama more as a Democrat, they'll like him more or they'll say, I still don't like him.
Mm-hmm. If you were advising the Obama campaign with 2 months left, what would you tell them to do?
I would tell them that they have to do everything they can to show people how much of his life has been spent with people like them. I would say, get students who are moderate Republicans who studied under him in the law school to talk about what a good guy he is, or show him and his wife off doing things and listening to people. show people that he's very American, not internationalist. Show people that he's comfortable in their world.
And what would you tell the McCain campaign? It's McCain this year, yes. What would you tell the McCain campaign?
He has to be consistent. He has done a very, very good job of putting a maverick edge on what is a very otherwise conservative record. And he has an extraordinary personal appeal. John McCain, you know, 591 people got released from the Hanoi Hilton when John McCain got released. He was the one who got all the attention. He got the cover stories. John McCain is the person whose bracelet during the Vietnam War, Ronald Reagan and Bob Dole wore. His story, because he'd gotten very well known when there was a tragic explosion on the deck of his carrier. So he has a story that many people feel is so compelling, he should have what he wants.
So, the last minute and a half, we've been talking about personal attributes. When I read the opinion polls, it looks to me like people are reverting to their primary partisan attachment. Nothing has changed. These two new candidates, McCain and Obama, and yet the opinion polls are showing a tight race, and it looks exactly like the last election. We're reverting to their old attachments.
Well, it's going to be tighter and tighter, but if it were really reverting to their party attachments, Obama would be 8 or 9 points ahead, not this tie or one. Obama and McCain are in an envelope of plus or minus 4 in all the polls. And some very, very good polls this week, CBS and The Economist. I'm doing the polling with Polymetrics and YouGov for The Economist. In those polls, you have Obama ahead. In some of the very good media polls, you have McCain ahead. But they're within 3 points. Mm-hmm. If you ask people who you get to vote for Congress, the Democrats are ahead by 8 or 9. If you ask in the Senate races, the Democrats are ahead. No Republican with ambition decided this was the year to start their career.
Right.
But so the race issue, the maverick issue, the Obama has problems with some Hillary voters and less educated working class voters who distrust him. McCain has a lot of problems with some religious groups and some fiscal conservatives who hate him over campaign finance reform. So there's 20% that's out there that everybody is scrambling over.
Pretty fascinating, Sam. It's always fun to talk to you about elections, and we'll keep doing it. There's a lot to watch, and we'll talk to you when it's all over and see what happens. That wraps up this edition of The Body Politic. We'll be back next month with more on the issues making news on the campaign trail. I'm Peter Gourovitch. Thank you, and good night.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.